We are the two mics.
We certainly are.
To On The Record, which is, of course, the ever-fast-growing podcast from friends at Audio Boom.
That's right.
We do two a week, one on Tuesday, one on Thursday.
That's
download
right.
them both.
Definitely.
Every single week. Yep. We now have, and we will be doing later on in the week, a Porky book review.
Yes.
Or as I like to call it, the Porky review of books.
Yes.
We also have Porky Vision.
We do.
And we also occasionally do an Ask Porky once a month.
We do.
So we'll be doing one of those soon.
Yeah. We might even go to Porky's postbag, because there's a lot
Porky's
of mail
postbag.
Coming in on this one. But I want to start off, Mike, talking about... During the careers we've had, long careers in journalism...
Wasn't some people would call them a career.
Well, I would as well. Was the one place where you went and did a story and you were so captivated by the place you'd been to, you said to yourself, one of these days, I have to come back here.
Yes.
I must come back. Now, it could have been before you got married to your wife, Susan. It could have been before anything else.
Yes.
But there was a place I went, which I was reminded of this week.
So you're not actually asking me a question.
I am asking you
a
question.
You're answering it.
No, I'm asking you a question because I'm going to point out something that happened to me. So I'll ask you first, was there anything like that? And then
I'll tell you
why I've asked the question.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you do it the other way around? Because I'll need to think about a place
That's great.
Where I should... Because I don't want to answer too hastily.
No.
So I'd rather hear your story.
That might...
And you may trigger something in my brain.
Exactly. You know. Trigger was the word I was looking for. So this week was the, sadly, the anniversary from 1979 when Lord Mountbatten got blown up on his boat off the Irish coast.
When you say sadly...
Yes.
I mean, you know,
it was
one
quite
of those tragic moments in history, but I sense that you're going to turn it into a story about you.
Yes.
So you don't really mean sad,
well,
do you?
Well, no, what I mean, actually, as far as I was concerned, and I don't mean this in the wrong way, it was good for me, Lord Mountbatten getting blown up.
That was good for you?
Yeah. Because
good for your career.
It kicked off my career,
It wasn't good. I mean, I thought your career had already been kicked off several times. I mean, you have spent the best part of the last few weeks, right, going on and on and on, droning on about the time that you were blessed by the Pope.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Now, I heard you saying
that,
telling
that story.
Of course,
the Pope's been in Ireland
recently. The Pope has been in Ireland recently, which is what triggered you to come out and start ranting and raving on about how the Pope, you know, the way you tell it, it's the way I tell them.
Yeah.
The way you tell it, you would think the Pope literally walked down the steps from the Vatican plane, right?
Yes.
This is Pope John Paul II in 1979.
Plane, actually. They sent a jumbo jet over there, the only one they had in the fleet.
You see that this Pope, who recently came, Francis, right? He arrives on Alitalia, goes home on it on Aer Lingus.
Aer Lingus, that's
now,
right,
is that one of those flexi fares you get from Expedia.com?
He didn't look much like the Pope this time, you know.
But should he not have come in on Alitalia and left on Alitalia?
Don't you think it was a bit undignified, posing for selfies, signing autographs and all that? I mean, and by the way, when I covered the Pope, not that I'm going to talk about the Pope anymore.
No, of course not, no.
The Phoenix Park Mass, which I covered, had 1.25 million people there. One quarter of the population of Ireland,
right?
Guess how many turn up this
200,000.
That's right.
Mind you, it was raining. Yeah. But my point is that the way you told the story of your experience of covering the Pope was that he more or less walked down the steps from the Aer Lingus jet.
Kissed the tarmac.
Went down on all fours, kissed the tarmac, and then walked straight over to you and gave you a blessing.
Well, not exactly.
That's kind of how you tell it.
He blessed us at Phoenix Castle. But anyway, listen. Dublin
Phoenix
Castle.
Park.
Dublin Castle.
Dublin Castle. Yeah, which... You know, when I heard you telling that story about Dublin Castle, you know what my first thought was?
No.
I said, yeah, I know the Dublin Castle. Mm-hmm. It's in Camden Town. It's a great pub.
Well,
it's just up the road from Camden Town Tube, very close to Dingwalls, where we once played.
Do you know, by a remarkable coincidence, you won't believe this, but the Dublin Castle was the pub that Dixie Dean took over in Chester after he retired. I'm not joking.
How bizarre.
The Town Hall Square in Chester, where we used to go and do the council meetings on a Thursday night.
Right.
And by the way, the council meetings were brilliant because they used to start at about sort of 6:30. Mm. So me and my mate, who had to cover them, used to go to the pub at 5 o'clock because the pubs didn't open till 5:30.
Yeah.
But the local landlords loved us because we were on the newspaper, you know what I mean?
You also spent quite a lot of money.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, all our wages, our wages. And they were always on a Thursday night, and on Thursdays we
presumably half the council were in there as well.
Well, they were. That would happen afterwards. But on a Thursday, you got a brown envelope, and it had £23 in it, literally, and a slip of white paper telling how much tax you'd paid and all that. So they always opened for us early on Thursdays, saying we all had pocketfuls of money, which they were going to take from behind the bar.
Right.
So we'd have an hour and a half in the booth.
The Dublin Castle.
Well, the one we went to was called the Diva Hotel because Chester used to be called the Diva.
Of course.
So, and so we go in there. But then what would happen at the council meeting is so boring, you'd fall to sleep.
Yeah.
Never wrote the stories down properly.
No.
It's too intensely boring.
Yeah, yeah.
And the only way you could find out if it was a story worth reporting on was to take a couple of the councillors to the Dublin Castle on Chester Town Hall Square afterwards.
Yeah.
And in the Dublin Castle in those days, there were nails knocked in the top of the bar and bits of material, you know, like rotting material. Hanging. They were Dixie Dean's international caps.
Oh, God.
Because Dixie Dean used to run it.
But isn't an international cap actually a cap, though, physically?
Yes, it's a cap. So, but they'd rotted, you know, moth-eaten and all that. You know, years later, they
wasn't that like some kind of a health hazard?
Well,
dripping into the beer.
No. I mean, they were just bits of material which had been there a very long time. You know, it was amazing. My father apparently took me there to meet Dixie Dean when I was about 5 or 6 years of age. That may have been where I got my attraction for public houses from.
Very
who knows,
possibly,
you know?
Yeah. But, no, that was because your father took you to one every day. Yeah, that was where you got your attraction to public houses.
Yeah, could have been.
While he was pretending to be at work.
Yeah, could have been. But anyway, that's the Dublin Castle. So. Anyway, what happened was... Yeah.
So you're going to tell me about some story that you went to cover, which made you... You're talking about Mountbatten, talking about the west coast of Ireland, right?
Well, here, how about this? Do you remember the first story that you ever did which involved you stepping on an aeroplane and going to where the story was happening? Can you remember that?
I do.
Can you?
I can.
All right, well, tell me that in a sec.
All right.
Because what happened was, it was a bank holiday Monday, and there has been a bank holiday in the week we're talking about now, right?
Yeah.
And I was looking after the news desk on the Birmingham Evening Mail, which is a very big evening newspaper
in those days.
330,000 a night.
Yeah.
It was all scaling down. Mm. I'd been working as assistant news editor. The news editor and the deputy had gone home.
Yeah.
And they said to me, just hold the fort for an hour, Mike, and then pack it
that
up.
That was their big mistake.
Yeah. They're very big mistake. Yeah. Just hold the fort, Mike, for an hour or so.
You must have been like Al Haig. Do you remember when Reagan was shot? Al Haig started careering around the White House.
I'm in charge.
Yeah. We were like, you're right, Al.
The world's press was saying, Mr. Haig,
what do you want to do? You're going to bomb the fuck out of Russia. Yeah. That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, you are the Secretary of State, but who is in charge of America at the moment? And he's sweating profusely. I was thinking about it. I am in charge.
And he looked like that mad guy from Network. Remember the movie Network?
Yeah, that's right.
We're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore.
That's right, yeah. So anyway, what happens is, I said, yeah, okay, fine. So I'm sitting there just wondering how long it's going to be before I get my first pint, you know, because it was sort of getting on to 5 o'clock.
Well, obviously, you would have had higher, hopefully, ambitions than when your first pint is going to come.
Absolutely. Mm. And we worked in a newsroom which was very big, but the next door newsroom was the Birmingham Post.
Yeah.
Birmingham Post is a small paper, 27,000 a morning.
Oh, okay.
Should never have kept it going as long
Why
as it did.
Why did bother?
Well, exactly.
Because it was at the day when evening papers were the kings.
Yes, of course they were.
Particularly in local, you know, like, not.
Exactly.
I'm not, I don't mean local, but smaller
Newcastle,
cities.
Newcastle, Birmingham, Liverpool, all
even
that kind
London,
of stuff.
Even in London, I mean, the Evening Standard, the Evening News, two papers.
That's right. Anyway, so what happened was, the PA feed switches over at 4:30 or 5 o'clock from the Evening Mail to the Birmingham Post.
PA being the Press Association, of course, of which you later became the kingpin.
The supremo, that's right.
Yeah.
So one of the lads from the Birmingham Post wanders over and says, oh, hi, mate, are you aware of this breaking story? Because there was nothing like Sky News in those days. We didn't have any televisions on. But, and I said, oh, what is it? And he said, Lord Mountbatten's been blown up in Ireland. Now, I have to admit, I didn't have a clue about the importance of Lord Mountbatten.
Right.
I didn't really know who he was.
Right.
He was a minor member of the royal family, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, is he? Oh, right, OK. Well, you know, that's a bit sad, isn't it? You know, and this kind of stuff.
Right.
So I thought, well, I suppose I better ring the news editor, who was about 25 years older than me, you know.
Right.
And the news editor had got home by
And did
now.
You know at this point he'd been blown up by the IRA?
No, didn't know anything.
Right.
Because you don't have information.
You just thought maybe his boat's blown up?
Yeah, or something like that.
Petrol leak or something?
Yeah, exactly. So I rang the guy at home, you know, and he says, I said, oh, hello, Ian. His name was Ian Mean. We used to call him
the Mean
Machine.
Right.
Yeah, he's very good, actually. Very sharp and on the ball. Yeah. He used to work for the Daily Mail.
Oh, yeah.
Before he had some sort of, you know...
What, you mean with a woman?
No, not at all.
Money, financial?
No, not at all.
What, then?
He was very ambitious at getting stories into the paper.
Oh, what, you mean he made a bit of a pulp?
No, well, I'm not saying that at all. There was something funny enough.
Is he still alive?
He's still alive,
Is he? Well, we better be careful.
And he became an evangelist, actually, as well, quite late on in his life. Yeah, and he's a good guy, a decent guy. But anyway,
he said he made something up, is what you're saying.
No, I'm not saying that at all. There was the way it goes is there was a boat got shipwrecked in the Irish Sea one night, and he was in charge of the Daily Mail news desk in Manchester, and apparently they were all in a Manchester nightclub giving it big, you know, like, you know, champagne, more, and he used to call everybody darling, by the way. So apparently this was the vernacular in those days. All right, darling, whether you were a man or a woman, all right, darling, brings out the bottle of darling, and some runner came down from the Manchester the Daily Mail Manchester building and said, you know, this ship's being shipwrecked on rocks near, you know, Dublin or something like that, you know. IRA gun running ship, you know, and it sort of went like that, you know what I mean?
And maybe it wasn't.
It probably wasn't, you know, because I think it had, I think it was a Libyan registered ship, so I assumed it was, you know, or whatever.
Well, that's
you know.
Not a bad assumption.
No, not a bad, except it was a fishing boat, and you know.
What were the Libyan fishermen doing off the coast of Cork?
Who knows? And for all we know, he could well have been right, but it was a question once again of where's the evidence, you know what I mean?
Yes, of course.
Which often catches all of us out.
Well, I've never been caught out because I've never made anything up.
No, exactly. You know. So anyway, what happens is I ring in at home and he said, what? I said, yeah, Lord Mountbatten's been blown up in Ireland.
Yeah.
What do you mean blown up? I said, I don't know anything more. I said, he was on a boat, the boat blew up.
Right.
He said, this must be a terrorist attack. He's the Queen's uncle.
Presumably you went steady in. You know what happened the last time.
That's right.
Let's not jump to any conclusions.
A bit of that, So he said, he's the Queen's uncle or great uncle or something like that. He said,
well, was he not like godfather to Prince Charles?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, all of that. Yeah, yeah.
He was his favourite. He was his favourite fucking uncle.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So he said, right, send somebody right away. So I said, well, there's nobody to send in. I said, it's me. I'm here in this vast, echoing newsroom, you know, with huge signals and all that. He said, well, you go then.
Right.
And I said, go where? He said, you go to Ireland. Get to the airport now and get on an aeroplane and go to Ireland. Right. Now, this is the famous story where Brenda Parry took my car.
Yes.
Right?
No, you took her car.
I took her car, sorry, that's right, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Poor old Brenda is the one who's the victim here,
not you. Yeah, that's right, because I didn't have any...
But here's the difficult thing, right, because and for people to listen to this story, they'll have to understand as well that for those of us who were brand new at this, at the time when I first got sent somewhere, you have no idea what you're supposed to do or how you're supposed to get there.
And
you're assuming to yourself, well, how am I going to do this? Am I going to, like, am I going to have to... Because you didn't have any money in those days. Credit cards. Nobody had a credit card.
No.
You couldn't just go to an airport
I think
and go...
I had one credit card with a limit of 50 quid or something
but also,
like that, you know.
Planes in those days were really expensive. There's no budget airline.
No.
So you probably have to spend about 400 quid to get there.
Yeah, so I said, okay. He said, get to the airport and ring me from there, okay?
Uh-huh.
So I drove to Elmdon, which is Birmingham Airport, which was very far away.
Right.
And luckily I had my car because it was a bank holiday. I'd driven in. Normally speaking, you know, I'd be working in Redditch or something like that as a reporter or something like that. So I got to the airport and then, you know...
Manchester Airport?
No, Elmdon in Birmingham. Oh, okay. Birmingham Elmdon Airport.
So is that now what, Birmingham...
It's Birmingham International.
International,
It's reasonably
big. Because there's two, isn't there? Is there East Birmingham?
No, East Midlands.
East Midlands,
there's East Midlands and there's Birmingham, So I rang him from there and he said, right, I've managed to get a hold of Kim.
Right.
Now, Kim was the very efficient news desk secretary.
Yes.
And she had managed, even though it was a bank holiday... to book me a ticket to Dublin, you know, in that half hour. As I said, he was very good at what he did, you know. And I said, OK, that's great. He said, so go to the Aer Lingus desk. He said, and
there'll be a ticket there,
and they'll also give you £100.
Right.
So apparently we had an arrangement with them, you know, where they... Yeah. So, great. Oh, this is brilliant, you know. So I said, what do I do when I get to Dublin? He said, you pick up a car. So, of course, that's when I got to Dublin. I didn't know whether it was Avis or, you know, wherever it was. So I just went to the first guy and said, oh, I've got a car booked. What's your name? Parry. Yeah, thank you. Is your name Brenda Parry? I said, it's Brendan. I said, Irish. Yeah, and...
to be sure.
Yeah. So I took her car. And 2 days later...
They didn't ask for a driving licence or anything, probably didn't.
Nothing. They don't in Ireland.
No.
And by the way, in those days, there were no drink drive laws in Ireland, which I found out in the next 3 or 4 days, you know. It was just, So I then go driving across Ireland, and you had to head basically for Sligo.
Yeah.
Sligo's the biggest town on the west coast in that part of Ireland.
And the roads are not great.
The roads in those days, before the EU started giving the Irish economy billions, were appalling.
Yeah, yeah.
At some places going across Ireland. You were down to single track roads. It was unbelievable.
That was like me in Devon recently, right?
Right.
Now, for some reason, I don't know whether, I'm just going to interrupt your story for a second. I don't know whether, and they keep saying to me that my family are giving me jip saying, you know, you've obviously got your sat nav set to go on small roads. I'm like, I haven't. I didn't have it. Yeah. But I actually ended up going through Fords. Can you imagine? Mm. You know, when you go through
could have done the brakes in on your car.
Well, no, because I've got four wheel drive. But I mean, if she tried to do it in her car, it would have been fucked.
Exactly.
But anyway, so I know bad roads are all happening in Devon.
Yeah. So let's get back to the Mountbatten story, see? So
you haven't even got to Mountbatten yet.
No, we haven't got to Mountbatten
yet. We're still getting there.
So anyway, so I...
you get on with it.
What do you mean, I get on with it?
Well, get on with it.
Of course, get on with it, yeah. So I land, and of course, you're full of adrenaline, and you're thinking, this is the first
time...
And
what time of night is it by this time?
Oh, 8 or 9 o'clock. Yeah. And of course, you've got to remember, this is the first time anybody's ever invested in me to fly on a story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, first time I've ever gotten an aeroplane to do in a story.
Yeah.
The only other time I've been on an aeroplane was to go and get bladderated in Mallorca with my mates, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I felt quite, you know, proud of myself.
Yeah.
I thought, nobody...
Oh, it's a massive thing.
Honestly, Mark, I'm not joking. I thought, nobody can ever take this off me. Mm. If my career collapses from now on, I was sent abroad, as I reckoned Ireland was, to cover the Lord Mountbatten story.
Of course.
Because at the airport, you picked up more information. It actually been blown up by the IRA and all that kind of stuff, you know. So so I drive across, and I reckon I got to Sligo about 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
Took about 5 or 6 hours.
Yeah, did you have a hotel booked or not?
Nothing at all like that. It wasn't. I mean, A, it wasn't sophisticated enough in Birmingham, but B, in Ireland, they just didn't have the facilities.
Right.
And then in Sligo, I found I had to go to a place called Mullaghmore, where Mountbatten had his castle. I think it was called Classybourne Castle.
Maybe.
Is that the one in Scotland?
I don't know.
Is that one of the Queen Mothers in Scotland?
Not Classybourne.
Okay, well, Classybourne then was his castle, right?
Yeah.
In Mullaghmore.
Yeah.
I got down to the beach, the most beautiful bay you've ever seen in the world. I mean, like, there was, it's where you're going to take the woman you're going to marry, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was so beautiful.
Yeah.
And all that was left were remnants.
Or the woman that somebody else has married, maybe.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, well, that would be even better, wouldn't it? Because then it divests you of the responsibilities.
You're thinking of the one in called Glams, I think it is, in Scotland, is it?
Glams.
The Queen Mother's, one of the Queen Mother's castles.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, it is. Yeah, well, she's like got, that. Apparently she had 2, Birkenhall, wasn't it?
Birkenhall, I don't
Birkenhall
know.
Castle. Sure. And anyway, point of the story is, I get there at sort of 3 or 4 in the morning, and there's like just a couple of guest houses in this place. I think it's like one hotel with 6 rooms.
Right.
I just bang on the door. Now, fortunately, because we were evening paper and we decided to move, we got the head of everybody else. So I got the last room.
So there weren't any Fleet Street hacks there?
Well, this is the amazing thing. I couldn't understand why there was nobody else there. You know, they all arrived the next morning.
Right.
But I got in there, well, when I say next morning, within 3 or 4 hours of me. But I got the only room, right, that was spare and got it and had a few quid, a few English pounds and all kind of stuff. You know, the £100 I got at the airport.
Yeah.
So I was so annoyed. But
did they leave the bar open for you?
You could have a drink any time you wanted in Ireland, at any time. I mean, it was just utterly amazing freedom of movement, you know. You thought, this is what a free country is like.
Yeah.
So, of course, the next 2 or 3 days, massively intensive. You're a preacher. We're working on the theory that Lord Mountbatten was bloodily killed by terrorist anarchists who are trying to bring down not just our family, but this country and all that kind of stuff.
Incredible,
you know?
Audacious terror attack.
Yeah.
Because they obviously had to get onto the boat.
Yeah.
So they had to somehow breach whatever the security was. They had to plant the bomb.
No, it was easy. I mean, that's the whole point. This was one of the first great IRA terrorist attacks.
Yeah.
His boat, which was called, it wasn't called Morning Cloud, that was Ted Heath's boat.
That was Ted Heath's boat, yeah.
Yeah, I can remember what it's called. Anyway, it's a very sad story because these two guys, one of them was an arch IRA bomber who had been taught his skills in Libya.
There you go.
He'd been there to a Libya training camp.
Yeah.
And the second one, and his name was Tommy McMahon. He was an arch bomber.
Uh-huh.
The second guy, Francis McGill, I think he was a hunger striker. The second guy, anyway, was a thick farmer's son who had to go along with Tommy McMahon just as a driver, really, basically.
Yeah.
They got to Mullaghmore. Went into the only pub there, which is the one with the rooms above, right, you know. Had a few drinks and said, you know, we understand that Mountbatten, oh, he's a sailor, isn't he? Because he, you know, he was big in the Royal Navy. Yeah. Oh, there's his boat. Oh, that's his boat, thank you. So when it went
off... So they told him,
They just walked along the front, jumped onto his boat, put the bomb on it, right?
Jesus.
Take the bomb to the engine. Mm. And then the following morning, They knew that Man Batten was coming down, and all his, you know, his people, members of his family, and the boat boy and all that. They were lying on the cliff at the top of the head, beyond the beach.
With a switch.
With a switch.
Yeah.
And the boat went out, and at the precise moment that they decided to, they pressed a red button and blew the boat up.
Wow.
And it is, I mean, there is no fun or funniness in this. A boat boy was killed totally innocently. Mountbatten obviously was killed. His daughter was badly injured. Yeah. I mean, it was and one of the Natchbulls, that was the Mountbatten family, was killed also. It was a shocking.
I remember it happening.
It was a shocking thing. Yeah. It was a massive story.
Yeah.
But it changed my life so completely because I thought Mullaghmore was so beautiful. But the following day, there was a picture in the Daily Star of the police inspector at Sligo Central Police Station talking about it, and beyond his right shoulder was me.
Oh, yeah.
It was unbelievable.
Right.
My father was ecstatic.
Was he?
My father cut the picture out of the Daily Star, put sellotape all over it, so it would never fade, and then put it in a frame and put it on the wall in his house.
How extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah. It was incredible.
Was that the only place the picture ran? Because it must have run other places as well.
Well, he cut it out of the Daily Star. I don't know why, because he was a Daily Express reader. Yeah, but I mean, Daily Express and Daily Star are owned by the same company and all that. Yeah. But, I mean, the amazing thing is, the impact that had on me, then what happened was, a couple of days later, because I'm smart than the average bear, I got a tip from somebody saying that they'd located the boat boy's family in Enniskillen.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Enniskillen is in the north of Ireland.
Where was another massive bomb later.
Yeah, well, exactly. Years later. Exactly. And to get there, you could drive up the west coast of Ireland through what is Ireland's Lake District.
Yeah.
The most beautiful part of the world I've ever seen.
Did you go through Killarney?
I've no idea, maybe.
Killarney is a place I played golf once.
Oh,
we went
on
a golf trip to, to Ireland.
Yeah.
And we took a ferry from Liverpool, I remember, going to Cork.
Yes.
It was a very drunken trip, so I can't remember too much about it.
Sure.
But we ended up in Killarney, which is one of the beautiful golf courses on the west coast of Ireland.
Yeah.
And I think it's in that kind of region.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Not far from the north.
But it is the Lake District of Ireland, and you're across the border from Ireland to Northern Ireland, got into Enniskillen. His father was a lecturer at the local college.
Yeah.
I went to the home. I don't know where I found the address from in those days. How did you find addresses? I don't know, you know, phone books and all that
kind
of stuff.
Incredible, actually, when you think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Phone books, mostly. Mostly phone books.
Phone books and all that kind of stuff, or talking to people. And eventually found him, sat down, talked to him. And I got a world exclusive, talking to the father of the boat boy, trying in the Birmingham Mail next day, and everybody else lifted, you know. So it's incredibly...
So where did you get the tip from?
I can't.
You sure
really
didn't nick it from something?
No. I really don't know. I just kept talking to people. The problem was, I was so keen in those days, I was on the case 24 hours a day. And it was the first time I realised that national newspaper reporters were basically a bunch of lazy bums who worked as a pack, who liked spending most of the day in the pub.
Yeah.
And I did many years later.
Thought, you know, that's what I want to do.
Eventually I want to graduate to that. Yeah. Who got paid 10 times more than I did. And who watched
who
each other...
Who picked up all the stuff from people like you.
Yeah, exactly. And watched each other's backs and made sure that none of them would ever be getting a late night phone call saying that the Mail's got this and everybody got the same.
Yeah.
It was a monopoly. It was a duopoly.
Yeah.
I mean, they had it all. And so I thought, well, I'm going up to find this guy. It happened to me 2 or 3 times, right? And... The other thing that happened, which was quite amazing, was the day after that, I got another tip from a policeman, right, who'd started to like me because I was always at the police station.
Yeah.
You know, as I said, literally all the national guys in the pub all day,
right,
just waiting for...
Your bosses must have been quite impressed as well.
Well, you know, I'm an impressive sort of guy.
Well,
but
up to a point.
You know, there are agencies, aren't there, all over Britain and Ireland and all that. And all the guys would sit in the pub and, bring me the stuff, bring this up. None of them had a desire to get exclusive over anybody else. So this policeman told me that... The man they suspected of being Mountbatten's killer was going to appear in Dublin Crown Court, or the equivalent, tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock.
Right.
And this is 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
He came and told me. I said, really? I said, are you sure? He said, I wouldn't be telling you, Mike. I wouldn't be telling you, Mike, if I didn't think you'd want to know. I said, right, thanks. So I ring Mean again, you know, and he said, you've got to get there. I mean, I was by that time so bladderated because I'd been on, although I was working very hard and I was drinking all day because the pubs are open all day in Ireland. Yeah. It's a novelty, you know. Right. So I must have had like 14 pints of Guinness.
So when you say working very hard, you managed to squeeze in the odd bite.
So anyway.
Did you ever have one of the things I remember when we played golf? Every single day we turned up on the front of the first tee and somebody had a load of paddy, you know, that Irish whiskey, and you'd pour it into a glass of milk.
Wasn't it called Powers?
No, it was paddy. No, it was called paddy. Oh, yeah. And it was paddy and milk. And that's what everybody drank on the first tee at fucking 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, about three shots of this stuff. You're going to give a shit how you played, you know, really, the latter, where the fucking ball went.
Yeah, anyway, to conclude this story, right, I had a Ford Escort, the Brenda Parry's Ford Escort.
Yeah, had she not caught up with you yet? She'd probably gone back to London.
Well, no, I think she caught up with me a couple of days earlier, but, you know, I denied everything and all that. But anyway, the point is, I then had to drive overnight to Dublin to get to the court case the following morning, you know, kind of quote exclusively. Yes. So I didn't tell anybody else. I just said, oh, I'm going to bed now. But, of course, being a scheming rat, you know, and...
well, of course, you didn't get where you are today, et cetera.
Exactly. I went to the hotel, packed my bag... put it in the Ford Escort, but then realised I only had less than half a tank of fuel.
Right.
And it had taken over half a tank of fuel to get from Dublin.
And where are you going to find a petrol station? That's something.
Well, this is the great story.
Yeah.
So I set off from Mullaghmore. I thought, I've got to go. What can I do?
Yeah.
I drive through Sligo, drive around Sligo a few times, no petrol stations there. I thought, well, I'm just going to have to drive until it runs out of petrol and see what happens.
Yeah.
I got about halfway across Ireland, right, and I went to this little village, as I say, the roads were awful, and there was a petrol pump outside a post office, right?
Just on its own?
Just a petrol pump.
Of those in Scotland as well.
Yeah, petrol pump outside a post office. Mm. And I thought, well, I've got no choice. I've got to try and make something happen.
Right.
So I stopped,
right,
and I got out, and it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I banged on the post office door.
Yeah.
And I banged and I banged and I banged. And 20 minutes later, believe it or not, the lock turned.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, so, it's absolutely surreal. Yeah, it was like being in a sort of a...
Were you at the point where there was no petrol left, practically?
Well, I don't think I'd have got more than a couple miles.
I thought you were going to say, I just decided to lift the nozzle and pour the petrol in.
Well, you couldn't, it was locked up.
I'm not even sure they could lock them in those days, could they?
No, it was locked up. There was a bar on it. I'd already tried that, you know, I'd already tried to steal it.
Right,
because I would have stolen it. I would have stolen it, no problem at all. So... the lock, and then the door opens, and a woman who is still asleep, right, with a cigarette in her mouth, okay.
Always safe, that.
Yeah. Wanders out. I didn't say anything to her. She unlocks the petrol pump, and I'd taken the cap off, and she puts the pump in the Ford Escort.
Yeah.
She is still smoking,
right?
I'm not joking. this cigarette never left her lips.
Yeah.
And when it filled up, it had so many... in those days, they had punts in Ireland, not euros. Yeah, they had the punt, it was about equal to the pound or something like that. So I saw... I didn't have any, you know... I might have had some punts or something. I just gave her, like, the equivalent of 20 quid or punts or something. She just took it, put it in a pocket, turned around and walked back in and closed the door.
Yeah.
That was it. There was no conversation,
no
nothing.
No conversation at all.
I mean, can you believe your luck? You know, I wouldn't have got to Dublin without this amazing woman who took 20 minutes to be knocked up out of bed, for want of a better word.
Well,
it's
not a good phrase in America.
No, and I got to Dublin. I got into a hotel in Dublin.
What time did you get to Dublin then?
Oh, about 8 o'clock, something like that.
Well, in the morning?
Yeah, about that. Because
That's the trouble nowadays. You get to a hotel at 8 o'clock in the morning, they don't give you a room.
No, but it didn't matter. I parked my car and I said, I'm coming back for a room later. Now, luckily, again, due to Mr. Mean, a mate of his worked on the Irish Evening Press.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And they took me under their wing and said, we'll give you a pass to get in the court and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I was the only English reporter in the court.
Right.
Once again, bang.
Right.
And because it was an evening paper, of course, we got it exclusively, picked up by everybody the following morning.
But why didn't anybody else pick up the Irish version?
I have no idea.
How bizarre.
I have no idea.
Very good.
What do you mean, the Irish version?
Well, I mean, the guys that were in the courtroom from the Irish papers.
That's right.
Why wouldn't they pick that up? Because I guess that wouldn't come out.
No, but what I'm saying is, I got first publication of it because it was an evening paper.
Oh, I see,
the other guys were morning papers.
So there were no wire guys in
there?
No
wire guys, nothing.
PA, nothing. I mean, is there... I don't know if there is an Irish wire service, is there?
Yes, there is. There is an Irish...
Irish Press Association?
Yes, there is.
Or something? Wouldn't they have put something out?
Well, yes, but the thing is, this was a secret hearing because of the sensitivity of it.
So they weren't there.
And IRA and all that. I was very lucky to get in. That's why I needed the pass from the Irish Evening Press, amazing. You know. It was amazing.
Amazing. Well, the only thing I can say about a place that I went first is nothing as dramatic as that.
Yep.
And to be honest, interestingly enough, I can't actually remember what the story was, but my first ever aeroplane ride at the behest of somebody else was actually in America. Because when I started my sort of journalism
career...
Yeah,
well, you were working in Bath on the Baker's News,
weren't you? Well, no, I mean, I did some local stuff in Bath. I did some subbing shifts and some reporting shifts in London for The Sun and for The Mail on Sunday, but they never sent me anywhere because I was like the world's most junior reporter. I was 23 years of age, sitting in the Sun newsroom in Bouverie Street, you know, with people like Nick Ferrari, who was their chief showbiz correspondent, you know, who used to go to Australia and get his eye punched out by Elton John's manager.
Yeah, that's
you know,
right. Yeah.
All that kind
well,
of stuff.
Well, he deserved that.
Well, he probably did, but bizarrely, because he'd asked Elton John's manager, who was his lover, whether Elton John was gay, and he punched him.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the way life goes.
Well, you know, Nick can be very provocative.
He can be. So so nobody there was going to send me anywhere. I mean, I was lucky if I got a shift to do the next day. So I went to work for The Star in America, which was Star Magazine.
Exactly. Of course, your girlfriend at the time was American.
She was indeed.
Yes.
And we decided that, you know, she couldn't work in England anymore, but I could go there and work. Yeah. So I got myself an I visa, got myself a week's work at The Star.
I had an I visa for a yearly one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you used to be able to get them. It's quite
can't get them anymore.
Well, you can still get them, but it's a bit more difficult apparently now. But in those days, it was easy. But of course, I was 23 years old when I went to America.
I was 23 when the Man Bat story thing happened.
I didn't have a care in the world. And it didn't occur to me that I could go somewhere and not succeed.
Yeah.
And it didn't occur to me that I would go somewhere and have to give up or run out of money or anything. Yeah. And I just thought, I'll go to America. I'll get an apartment, I'll get a job, it'll be fine. Because that's how you think. And I always remember the first time they came to me, I did some work for The Star for about a week or two before they came to me and said, we want you to go to Florida.
Yeah.
And I went, great. And there was a guy called Peter Williams there, you might remember.
Yeah, I do. He ended up in Austin, Texas, didn't he?
He did. He ended up in hiding, actually, because he had a hit put out on him.
Oh,
because he had an affair with this stewardess, right? He was quite partial to the ladies. And he was actually quite a ladies' man. And he picked up with this air stewardess who worked for American Airlines.
I was going to say,
But it turned out her boyfriend, or her last boyfriend, I think it was a bit iffy as to whether or not she'd broken up with him, was a former NFL player. Right, and he didn't take
National
too
Football
kindly.
League,
he didn't take too kindly to hearing that this limey was stupping his missus. You know?
Yeah.
So he put a fucking contract out on him,
right?
Because he knew those kind of people.
Yeah.
And he used to play for the Dallas Cowboys or something.
So how did Peter find out there was an assassin walking
Somebody told him
to wipe him out.
Somebody said, by the way, because he used to know a few rum people.
Yes.
And he said, by the way, I heard your name mentioned. He said, how do you mean? He said, well, I heard your name mentioned in passing, and it's not a situation you want to find yourself in. And he went, well, who's been talking about me? He said, well, I was talking to some associates, and your name's been put on a list, and there's a reward for getting you.
Yeah.
And he said, what do you mean for getting me? He said, for killing you. And Peter said, what are you fucking talking about?
And where was this?
This was in Dallas.
In Dallas.
The guy had taken a hit out in Dallas on Peter Williams. So he had to go into hiding in San Francisco.
He was working in Austin then, was he?
He was in Dallas.
Yeah, I thought he lived in Austin.
No, he was in Dallas.
Yeah, okay.
And he had to go. In fact, I had to cover a story for him. Very bizarre thing.
Yeah.
I had to cover a story for him that he was meant to cover.
Right.
But I had to pretend to be him. But it wasn't until after I pretended. And I said, well, hang on a second. When he told me this story, he said, the reason I can't go after I was there... he said, it's because somebody's taken a hit out of me. I said, so what? So you've booked yourself into a fucking hotel in Salt Lake City, right?
Yeah.
And I'm in that room.
Yeah, right,
I said, so I might get killed. He said, no, you'll be fine. You don't look anything like me.
No.
I said, yeah, but what if some maniac comes,
that.
Yeah,
what if some
maniac
blow up
comes
the room.
In and puts two fucking shots in the pillow
that
I'm lying on? That'll be the end of me.
Exactly.
But very quickly, the job that I went to was in West Palm Beach in Florida.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a driving license at the time, right?
Right.
And I'm, again, a bit like you, I was thinking, how the hell am I going to get there?
Yeah.
No idea.
Yeah.
Next thing I know, this very lovely secretary who used to be on the news desk at the Star magazine, sort of Italian-American girl, comes over, hands me a ticket, gives me $500 in cash, and gives me a voucher to rent a car.
Right. Brilliant.
And I took it all, but of course I couldn't use the voucher to rent a car because I had no license.
Well,
so when I arrived, it turned out they couldn't fly me into West Palm Beach.
Yeah.
They had to fly me into Fort Lauderdale.
Right.
And I came out there and I thought, I'll just get a cab. What I didn't realise was that
it's about
120 miles.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, so guess what?
Sure.
Instead of getting a cab who wouldn't take me, they were all like, no, sir, it's too far. You know, I'm not going to go all the way down there.
Yeah.
I got a stretch limo. to take me from Fort Lauderdale to fucking West Palm Beach.
Yeah.
Which I thought was the greatest thing I could have ever done.
Yeah. How did you pay for it?
I paid for it cash.
Out of the $500?
Yeah. Because I thought, because in those days you were quite creative.
But were you going to have to pay for the hotel with the $500?
No, the hotel was paid.
Oh, I see, yeah.
So I just, this was just running around money.
Okay.
You know, and I was able to cover it later by getting receipts from restaurants and all that.
Did you not try to tell the hire rental, the car hire rental people that I left my...
I didn't have any... Left well, no, because I couldn't drive.
Oh,
I,
you couldn't literally didn't know how to drive a car?
I never learned how to drive when I was living in Britain. Right. So I never had to.
Yeah.
I was living in London, right?
Yeah.
Where I was taught to drive by my ex-wife? Mm. In Shea Stadium car park.
Right, exactly.
She taught me how to drive.
Yeah.
And that's where I learned to drive.
Brilliant.
But there we are.
There we are.
With the two mics.
The problem was, I was so keen in those days, I was on the case 24 hours a day. And it was the first time I realised that national newspaper reporters were basically a bunch of lazy bums who worked as a pack, who liked spending most of the day in the pub.
Yeah.
And I did many years later.
Thought, you know, that's what I want to do.
Yeah, yeah. Eventually I want to graduate to that. Yeah. Who got paid 10 times more than I did. And who watched each other.
Who picked up all the stuff from people like you.
Yeah, exactly. And watched each other's backs and made sure that none of them would ever be getting a late night phone call saying that the mail's got this and this, everybody got the same.
Yeah.
It was a monopoly. It was a duopoly.
Yeah.
I mean, they had it all. And so I thought, well, I'm going up to find this guy. It happened to me two or three times, right? And the other thing that happened, which was quite amazing, was the day after that, I got another tip from a policeman, right? Who'd started to like me because I was always at the police station.
Yeah.
You know, as I said, literally all the national guys in the pub all day, just waiting for...
Your bosses must have been quite impressed as well.
Well, you know, I'm an impressive sort of guy.
Well, but up to a point.
Some runner came down from the Manchester, the Daily Mail Manchester building and said, you know, this ship's being shipwrecked on rocks near, you know, Dublin or something like that, you know.
Right.
IRA gun running ship, you know, and it sort of went like that, you know what I mean?
And maybe it wasn't.
It probably wasn't, you know, because I think it was a Libyan registered ship, so I assumed it was, you know, or whatever.
Well,
you
that's
know.
Not a bad assumption.
No, not a bad, except it was a fishing boat, and you know.
What were the Libyan fishermen doing off the coast of Cork?
Who knows?
But bizarrely, because he'd asked Elton John's manager, who was his lover, whether Elton John was gay.
Yeah.
And he punched him.